Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. The rates of sexually transmitted diseases in the United States are at an all-time high. That's according to a new report from the Centers for Disease Control. 2017 marked the fourth straight year STD rates have risen in the U.S. So what's going on? Joining us is the director of the Center for Sexuality and Health Disparities at the University of Michigan, Rob Stevenson. He joins us now by phone. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, good morning. Thank you for having me.
How high is the all-time high? Can you give us a picture of this?
Well, if you look historically, we see that STD rates increased rapidly after the Second World War in the U.S., and then we had a period of steady growth over the next few decades, and then it declined with the onset of the HIV epidemic in the 80s, just because more people were getting tested and therefore treated. We're now seeing a steady increase in that again. We're going back up to potentially an all-time high in the next 5 years.
Well, why did it increase after World War II?
More sex, frankly. I think it's more sex and more testing again. We saw rapid increases after World War II in chlamydia, gonorrhea, and syphilis as people returned from war. More sex happened, more testing happened. The more you look for it, the more you'll find.
And again, then, therefore, it went down during the HIV epidemic because people were having less sex.
Okay. Yeah, less sex, and we were also, as we were encouraging HIV testing, people were also getting tested for STDs. We were identifying more. If we treat more infections, we stop the spread of infections.
This is the fourth straight year we've seen a rise in STDs in the U.S. Why do the numbers rise like that within 4 years?
Well, there are two possible explanations. One is it's a real trend, and the other is that we are just detecting more. My personal take on this is that it is, in fact, a real trend. We're seeing a steady increase in the prevalence of the three most common STDs, chlamydia, gonorrhea, and syphilis. I think we're taking our eye off prevention. One of the things that's happening is that we're switching STDs to a curative response. All three common STDs are curable through antibiotics, and I think there's a slow mind shift, particularly among younger generations, that if you get an STD, you take penicillin or an antibiotic and it's cured. While that's true, we still want to prevent them. So I think the way to combat this is to switch our mindset back to prevention rather than purely conceiving these as a curative response.
And long term, if we just focus on a curative response, that affects the cure long term, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, the potential thing that is coming is antibiotic resistance STDs, and that's a place we really don't want to go. If you look at gonorrhea, for example, in the U.S., we're seeing an increase in antibiotic resistant gonorrhea. Of the the five treatment options for gonorrhea, we're really down to one efficacious treatment now because we've developed resistance to others. I think at least 30% of gonorrhea cases now in the U.S. have antibiotic resistance.
Wow. I mean, that's serious.
That is a serious concern. I mean, the lens to view this through, though, I think the only way we're going to be successful is to keep a sex-positive lens on this. I am no way ever saying we should all just stop having sex and read a book. That is not what I'm saying. Exactly. Good luck with that. We need to teach prevention from an early age. We need to do a better job of educating people, what STDs are, what bacterial and antibiotic resistance is, and also to give people the actual behavioral skills to avoid infection.
The role of the federal government, I wanted to talk about that because there hasn't been an increase in STD education funding since 2013, right?
That is correct.
So is that part of this scenario?
Yeah, I think here we see a real direct impact. If we're going to cut our funding for STD prevention and HIV prevention or sexual health overall, we cannot then sit back and be surprised to see an increase in rates. We need to start, look at countries who do well. And I always tell people to look at the Netherlands for, great sexual health outcomes. They start sexual education at a very young age. And it's not just, these are the bits of your body to be aware of. It's more about communication skills, behavioral skills. How do you talk to your partner about sex? That's where we need to invest our money, into actually teaching people to understand the risks that come with sex, but also to have a sex-positive mindset.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is Rob Stevenson. He's professor and chair of systems, population, and leadership at the University of Michigan School of Nursing, where he is also directs the Center for Sexuality and Health Disparities. If you have a question or comment, we're talking about the rise in sexually transmitted diseases in the United States. It's at an all-time high after 4 years of increases. Ashley in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Ashley.
Hey, Ann. How are you doing?
Good.
So I went to a very affluent high school here in Columbus. I don't want to say which one. Okay. I graduated in the mid-aughts. And we were literally taught in our health class, our teacher was religious, but we were taught that condoms do not prevent pregnancy or STDs because the molecules between, or the latex molecules, are too far apart to prevent an STD. And I know that that's actually, I have friends from school who still believe that.
Okay, well, Rob Stevenson, is there anything to dispel here right off the bat?
Yes, thank you for bringing that up, Ashley. That is, in fact, a myth. Condoms are an excellent way of preventing unwanted pregnancy and preventing most STIs. Long-term, there are not great pregnancy prevention because most people don't use condoms consistently. So if you're looking at pregnancy prevention, there are lots of long-acting contraceptive methods that do a better job. But in terms of protecting STIs, a condom is your best bet.
Okay. Ashley, thank you for that call. It's good to know, I think, and kind of scary, right, Rob Stevenson? Okay, so here's another thing. I mean, we drop off our funding for sexually transmitted disease education in 2013. Every year there's a new batch of sexually active youngsters, right?
That is correct. I think we are seeing a decline in the age of first sex. So I think people are having sex at a younger age. But, you know, the whole point of this, as I said before, is to be sex positive. I mean, we are foolish if we're going to think that people are going to stop having sex or young people are not going to have sex.
Mm-hmm.
You need to equip them with the skills. It's the right thing to do.
The HIV epidemic, it went down because people were afraid. But was there any kind of long-term effect of that that still remains?
Long-term effect in what way?
In terms of the impact of the HIV epidemic on our consciousness.
The U.S. has a complicated history with its with its HIV epidemic, rather. We've seen declines in every risk group except men who have sex with men. Men who have sex with men, particularly young men who have sex with men between the ages of 13 and 24 and young MSM of color, are the only groups who are seeing a rapid increase in HIV incidents. So I think we've done a good job with heterosexuals, with injection drug users, in declining HIV rates, but where you see the highest prevalence is also where we see rapidly increasing incidents. So we need to do a better job, again, of providing stigma-free prevention efforts for the young generations who need them.
You mentioned injection drug users. There is another epidemic going on right now, and that is the heroin/opioid epidemic.
That is correct, yeah.
Any correlation there?
Correlation with STDs, I actually don't know. If I was to guess, I would say it would make sense. We know that people who are substance users are much more likely to have risky sex, take sexual risks, and for many reasons it could be disrupting your decision-making process while you're on substances. It could be using sex as a mechanism for getting substances.
Mm-hmm.
Many potential pathways through which the substance use epidemic could, in fact, mirror the STD epidemic we're seeing.
There has been an increase in primary and secondary syphilis. What's the difference between them? What's the distinction and why does it matter?
That is a good question. Sorry. Syphilis tends to be asymptomatic. And so if you
meaning you don't know you have it.
Yes. So the common symptoms would be a rash on the palm of your hand, would be the classic one that I would see, or discharge, or urination, burning on urination. These would all be classical symptoms. I think around 3/4 of syphilis is actually asymptomatic, which brings back to the point of regular testing. And I kind of mentioned this earlier, and I will answer your question. This moving from a curative to a preventative response, we tend to get tested when we think we have a problem.
Mm-hmm.
we don't do that with our cholesterol. Why don't we make STD testing part of a routine health checkup?
Hmm.
Why can't it be, you know, weight check, cholesterol check, STD test?
Hmm.
You know, it could be routine. I think that's the way to really get to the way of combating it.
Is it expensive?
Not in a primary care setting, no. And yeah, widespread testing, if you're actually going to prevent many new infections, long-term is going to be economically more viable.
I can't remember, but I think I had STD tests done when I became pregnant.
Yes, that sounds about right.
That would be kind of typical, but guys, they don't have that kind of red flag opportunity to do it, and they often don't have symptoms. Is there differences in these rates between men and women?
Rates of syphilis infection are much higher among men, particularly men of sex with men. We're seeing the classical epidemiology of this is that we see increase in STD infections across genders, particularly in the 15 to 24 age groups, although it's stretching more into the 30s. Chlamydia and gonorrhea tend to be more prevalent among young women, and syphilis much more among men, particularly men of sex with men. But you're right, there is, outside of antenatal care, men don't have the equivalent. There's no time when you're tested unless, I think if you go to jail, maybe, which is not a great public health strategy. But it's switching the onus as well. So providers are getting used to just asking their clients for routine STD testing.
We were talking about, we focus on the cure more than the prevention now, but is there a point of no return when it comes to a cure?
What do you mean?
If you wait too long?
The danger with syphilis, and I will answer your question that you asked me earlier about primary and secondary syphilis. Mm-hmm. There are three stages to syphilis, primary, secondary, tertiary. Primary syphilis is the first stage of the disease, and if you aren't treated, you will progress to secondary. And if you aren't treated, there is the danger of tertiary syphilis, which has real neurological effects. So, and then across other STDs, there's risk of pelvic inflammatory disease, there's risk of reproductive impairment. There's lots of other ways that STDs can progress and affect your health, which is why, routine testing is the way forward.
And that's what you're saying for everyday people, non-medical professionals, just get tested.
Yeah, make it part of get your cholesterol checked, get your weight checked, get your STD checked. It's not painful. It's a quick swab and it's a quick... I'll get back to swabbing in a moment. It's a quick swab or a quick blood draw. It's actually not a painful exercise.
And what do you want to get back to about swabbing?
We need to... my favorite sentence of the day.
Yeah.
We need to look for STDs where we expect STDs. It's really interesting that I have a study at the moment where we send men STD testing kits to their own home. They swab themselves. They send them back. We run the lab results and we, call them with the results. It allows them to do it in their own home. You can buy these kits yourself online and send them in. You don't even have to go to a doctor to be tested. But when you go to a doctor, normally it's a clean urine catch. They ask you to pee in a cup. But we should also be looking pharyngeal, so in the throat and rectal. You should look for an STD where you have sex. And so I see a lot of men in my studies where we call them and, say, you have gonorrhea or chlamydia or something. And they're like, but we were just checked. That's because they were checked.
Wow.
Yes. So look for it.
Where you do it.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, Rob Stevenson, thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
It was my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
So we've been talking about the rates of sexually transmitted diseases spiking, all-time high after 4 years of increases. My guest has been Rob Stevenson. He directs the Center for Sexuality and Health Disparities at the University of Michigan. More Wellness Wednesdays coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. One or two glasses of wine a day can't hurt. That's what many have thought. But a massive new study published last week in The Lancet suggests otherwise. Researchers analyzed nearly 1,000 studies on alcohol-related disease from around the world and concluded that the only safe amount is none at all. Joining us is physician and expert in epidemiological research at Stanford University School of Medicine, Dr. John Ioannidis. Welcome to the show.
Very happy to join you.
This study found that not even one drink is safe to consume. Now, I'm sure there's lots of people listening thinking, I've had a lot more than one drink. What is it telling them?
Well, this is a monumental study. It did include tons of data and tons of evidence. And if you want to summarize it, I think there's two conclusions. One is that alcohol is one of the major problems for health around the world. It ranks number 7 in terms of the burden of disease that it induces, and maybe it's even higher than that because lots of people will not probably disclose that they drink a lot. So clearly, major health problem. Number 2, a misconception, a conclusion that no alcohol is ever to be consumed because otherwise you're at risk. I think that this is a misconception from the study. It does show that the risk may start going up at a very low level of consumption. But in terms of absolute risk, if you drink anywhere between 0 and 1 drink per day, your risk is as close to 0 as it can be. It's virtually indistinguishable from 0, or we're talking about very, very subtle increases in risk.
So not to get all supercharged about it, but the point is that alcohol is involved in a lot of disease.
Absolutely. There's 23 major diseases that study tried to analyze, and if someone is drinking a lot of alcohol, it's one of the worst things that they can do with their life.
Are we talking about diseases that are just, gastroenterological, or could it be other things?
Oh, it's lots of different things. So it's liver disease, it's high blood pressure leading to heart attacks and strokes. It's dementia, mental problems, depression. You just name it. So, you know, in high levels, alcohol is a horrible idea. But at the level of 0 to 1 drinks per day, mm-hmm. Or maybe even a bit more than that, the risk is really very, very, very minor, I would say, indistinguishable from 0.
And you said it's 7th in the world. Are there some countries that are more affected by it than others?
Obviously, it varies a lot around the globe. There are some countries where alcohol is even socially prohibited. And the question is, how reliable is the evidence that we have in terms of the prevalence of high alcohol consumption in these countries? So there's quite a lot of variability. It is something that is socially linked. This also means that there should be ways that we could cut back in terms of the magnitude of the problem worldwide.
What do we learn from countries where it's prohibited? I mean, obviously, some people still drink there, but it's very, very small. Does that tell us anything about, are they healthier?
I think it's very difficult to make comparisons between countries because obviously there's many other factors that would be different in terms of the socioeconomic environment, the prevalence of other risk factors for disease, how people go about their lives. Overall, dealing with alcoholism as a societal problem is a good thing. And I believe that you don't have to have religious reasons or ethical reasons to do that. You can just go by just the health benefits of mm-hmm. Of removing that health problem from the radar screen.
And does it matter what kind of alcohol you drink, whether you drink, whiskey or wine or, tequila?
Well, alcohol is alcohol. Mm-hmm. The available studies do suggest that there is a difference in the risk for different diseases. But it's very hard to tell whether these differences are real or whether they're just connected with other features, characteristics, social environment, and what we call confounders that may be different in people who drink beer or spirits versus those who drink wine. Many studies have shown that there are clear differences in the type of people who would drink one type of alcohol versus another type of alcohol. So if you have someone who's from a lower socioeconomic status or more likely to have less secure job, be involved in different types of occupations, and if that pattern is associated with the type of alcohol that they consume, all of these other factors may also have some bearing on their risk of disease for other reasons. So it's very difficult to disentangle.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about this massive new study that looks at the global impact of alcohol consumption. And bottom line is that the best drink is the one you don't take. My guest is Dr. John Ioannidis. He is an expert in epidemiological research at Stanford University. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. The study looks at 1,000 other studies. What's the time frame for all those studies? How far back do they go?
Well, they did go pretty far back. They were very inclusive in what they tried to synthesize. And here, it's not easy to tell whether all studies should be discarded, should be weighted less, we should pay less attention to them. Usually, you try to be inclusive when you get this type of bird's eye view of the evidence. But obviously, not all studies are created equal. Lots of these studies have biases. They may have errors. They may have problems to address some of these other factors, which might be confounding the results. And some of them may also have conflicts of interest. So, for example, there's conflicts of interest both from the alcohol industry that may be trying to influence the results and get more favorable results, but also from researchers who may have a very strong belief that no alcohol is safe, and therefore they may be interested to find results that would support their claim.
And so this research tries to suss that kind of thing out and account for it.
Exactly. It's trying to create a big average in a sophisticated way. And I think it's doing a pretty good job in that regard, other than the fact that if you have studies that are flawed in one way or another, it's very difficult, if not impossible, to correct them after the fact.
Hmm. Phil in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Phil.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. Go ahead.
I just wanted to say, it seems to me like this is data mining. You know, every other week it's, you know, coffee's good for you, coffee's bad for you, alcohol's good for you, alcohol's bad for you. It just doesn't seem like it's, I don't know. Who was it that you said that posted this study?
Who was? Lancet. It's posted in Lancet.
Okay. I don't know. It seems like it's every other week that something else is good for you or bad for you. Mm. I mean, I personally don't drink much. I maybe have glass of wine a month. But I do know people that drink a lot, and I worry about them, their health. But you know, I just don't think that the studies like this are that legitimate. I just think that they just look for stuff in the thousands of studies.
All right. Well, Dr. Ioannidis, how do you respond to that?
So I think that there is a fair criticism here that this type of study is very difficult to do and get objective results that are unbiased. And this is indeed true. These studies are biased. They do have errors. They have difficulty to account for the complexity of other things that would affect our health. However, I want to separate two big domains. One is heavy consumption of alcohol, and clearly the risks here are very strong, they're very high. There's no doubt about that being a serious problem. Second domain is low level, which is like one drink per day. And here I think that we don't have a clear answer whether one drink per day is something that is going to be harmful, neutral, or even beneficial in some cases. The risks that study estimates for one drink per day are so subtle, they're so weak that any noise would be much stronger than the signal. Mm. And it's unlikely that we will be able to get a conclusive answer or this low level of consumption with this type of observational studies. They're not suited to give us reliable answers when we're in that range of extremely low risk. To give you an impression of how low the risk is, with one drink per day, the estimated risk is that 25,000 people consuming 400,000 bottles of gin over a year, one of them will get a serious problem. David Spiegelhalter, who's a statistician at Cambridge, did that calculation for us, and I think it puts into perspective how small the risk is and how difficult it is to estimate with accuracy with this type of investigation.
Phil, thanks a lot for that call. Anybody else? 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. What about gender and race? Does that play a role in any of this?
Well, there are analyses for gender and race, and they might show some small differences, but they should not lead us astray from the key messages. The key messages pertain to both men and women, and to people of very different ancestry. So no one should think that they're immune if they drink tons of alcohol. Mm-hmm. And same lack of clarity would exist for very low levels of consumption for everyone.
I'm wondering about gender markers, too. There was a day, and I don't know if it's still the case or not, and I'd like to put it to rest if it's not, but that Native American Indians were more susceptible to it. Is there anything like that?
I think it would take away from the strength of the message if we start focusing on potential differences between different groups of different genetic ancestry. Everyone is susceptible more or less to high levels of alcohol. Some of us may have different metabolism in terms of how we metabolize alcohol, but that, you know, shouldn't be a reason that people should behave differently and say that I have a genetic background that would protect me. That's not going to be the case.
And kind of going back to the point that Phil made about data mining, this Lancet's, it's a big deal to get into Lancet. What are the criteria to get into Lancet when it comes to a study like this? How hard is it?
Well, I think that the acceptance rates for papers that go to a journal like Lancet are in the range of 3-5%. And obviously, people will send their very best studies. They don't send everything to the Lancet.
Mm-hmm.
So practically, we're talking about a highly competitive environment. And that may lead to some propensity of making some extreme claims. So one needs to watch out. The peer review in these journals is pretty rigorous. Obviously, it's not that all errors will be caught, but it's not that it's nonsense being published. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's lots of effort by several scientists who look at the paper and try to judge its merits and its weak points. At the same point, as I mentioned, some of the papers that appear in these journals, and this paper may fall into this category, they may go ahead and make extreme claims like absolutely no alcohol is claimed, period, which is a little bit of an exaggeration, or actually quite an exaggeration compared to what they found.
But it definitely gets our attention. What do you think the long-term ramifications are? What healthcare providers, should they be telling their patients something different now today than they would have a week ago?
I think that clearly we need to deal with alcohol as a health problem. And, high-level consumption is something that we need to prevent and something that we need to treat. In terms of the casual question, should I drink anything or nothing, or how big is the risk? The answer to that would be the risk is very minor, if any, if you just drink something like one drink per day or less. Should we encourage that? Should we say don't do it? We don't know, to be honest. I don't think that people should be terrified. If they drink one drink per day, that's perfectly fine. Probably in terms of absolute terms of risk. Do we need more knowledge? I think we do. I think we need some randomized trial that would randomize people to have one drink per day versus have none, and see what happens down the road many years later. If we have a randomized trial, it would be different compared to all these epidemiological studies where people drink, but they also do many other things at the same time that make them different.
We have been talking about a new study published last week in The Lancet that suggests that the best amount of alcohol to drink is none at all. My guest has been physician and expert in epidemiological research at Stanford University School of Medicine, Dr. John Ioannidis. Thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate your time today.
Thank you for inviting me. Have a wonderful day.
You too. We'll have more Wellness Wednesday coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Timing is everything when it comes to the human body. Everything is programmed to run on a 24-hour or circadian schedule that dictates times for everything from sleeping to eating. Now, if we can just listen to our bodies. Circadian biologist at the Salk Institute for Biological Studies in La Jolla, California, Sasha Banda, recently wrote about the issue for The Conversation. We'll post a link to it on our website at allsides.org/allsides. Sasha Banda joins us now. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Good morning.
How does, let's do the primer on what the circadian clock is again.
Well, circadian rhythms are really timetables of many biological activities that happen in our body. Just like going to bed and waking up in every 24 hours is a circadian rhythm. Almost every hormone, every brain chemical, every enzyme, and even every gene in our genome rises and falls in every day. And these waves of gene activity, brain activity, are controlled by what we call circadian clocks that are present in almost every cell in our body.
It feels sort of overwhelming, and there are a lot of signals that we should be hearing, but we don't anymore, right? So we have to artificially be adjusting ourselves?
Well, we humans... We lived with circadian rhythms for almost 200,000 years on this planet, but we didn't actually know, understand the importance of it until now. We just woke up to it because almost all of us go through various circadian disruptions. We stay awake late into the night. We eat throughout whenever we are hungry, even in the middle of the night. So those disruptions are waking us up, and we are understanding that now these rhythms matter. So what we can do to begin with, follow very simple rules about when to sleep, how long to sleep, when to eat, and for how many hours in a day we should eat and give some rest to our body. And once we follow these simple rules, then the body's rhythms will come back to place and everything else will fall into its right place. We'll feel more healthy. We can prevent or even sometimes reverse some chronic diseases.
I get the don't eat in the middle of the night thing. That's just kind of a no-brainer, but sometimes still people still do it. But you're talking about timing our meals during the day. How so? Why is that important?
Well, it's not about exactly timing when we should eat lunch or snacks. It's the timing of the first calorie of the day and timing of the last calorie of the day. Because during that time, between the first and last calorie, that's when the body is really working to absorb nutrition and supply it to different organs and storing a little bit. And then after the last calorie, for the next 4 to 5 hours, the kitchen is essentially shutting down. Everything slows down. And then after 4 to 5 hours, the body goes into what we call repair mode. So we cause a lot of damage to our internal system. and those things need to be repaired every day. So having that overnight fasting of nearly 12 to 16 hours is really important, because that's when all the repair, rejuvenation, all these processes work. And if that doesn't happen, then we get slowly closer to various diseases.
And everybody's sort of the same on this score.
Yeah, everybody has the same 24 hours clock. Everybody's body, like our internal organs, they repair. The toxins or many unwanted chemicals that we eat, they don't have to be toxins. For example, food color, food preservatives, and even natural flavors, all of these, body actually doesn't need those. They have to be broken down. Some cholesterol needs to be broken down. All of these things at time to occur only in the middle of our sleep or middle of the night. Similarly, growth hormone is produced in the middle of the night to repair and grow our some of the organs. So these programs are same for everyone on this planet.
And if my body, and if I eat something before I go to bed, it's not like, oh, is it necessarily that one part of my body is working to digest that instead of doing something else that it's supposed to be doing, or it just doesn't digest it properly and that creates other problems?
Actually, the answer is both.
Okay.
Because in the middle of the night, our digestion system actually slows down. Our stomach doesn't move that well, doesn't push the food down the intestine. So that happens. And at the same time, our intestine needs to repair itself. So gut lining needs to repair. Nearly 1/7 to 1/10 of all the cells are replaced in the gut lining. So just like imagine if you want to repair a highway in the middle of the night, you got to shut down the traffic. You cannot repair well when the traffic is still flowing. So that's exactly what happens. The food, you eat something or we eat something that doesn't digest very well. It's just sitting there, and it's also interrupting the repair process.
And, you know, we hear lots of different ideas about diets and people who eat six times a day but smaller amounts and that kind of a thing. Does that play a role in any of this?
Well, when people are advised to eat six times a day smaller meals, it doesn't mean that as long as our eyes are open, our mouths should be open. but what we tend to do is we wake up and we start eating small meals until we go to bed. And that's not the idea. The idea is you can actually eat those five or six small meals or three big meals within, say, maximum 10 to 12 hours window, mm-hmm. and you can still be healthy. Because if you do the math, it's very simple. The sleep society says that we should be sleeping or we should be in bed for 8 hours. Okay, so take that 8 hours, and then we should not be eating anything within an hour of waking up, because that's when our hormones are adjusting, our day hormones are rising, our night hormones are falling. It's not a good idea to eat at that time. So 8 plus 1, 10 hours. And then it's a common sense that you should not eat 2 to 3 hours before going to bed, because that's when, again, our gut is digesting food and core body temperature doesn't fall, so you cannot sleep well. So now you've got 9 hours plus 2 to 3 hours. You are reaching almost 12 hours
mm-hmm.
when the common sense says that we should not be eating. And if we just follow that common sense as such, that gives us a 12 hours rest period for our body to repair and rejuvenate. And then if you want to add 1 or 2 hours to that fasting period, then that's much better.
Then why do we feel hungry sometimes? So some people get up in the middle of the night, they feel hungry, they want a snack. What is it in the body that's making you feel hungry if their circadian rhythm saying, no, it's time to repair our organs and repair the digestive system?
Well, what happens is a lot of people, their circadian clock is broken because of this random eating. So then the body's hunger satiety clock doesn't run very well, and that can make people wake up feeling a little hungry. At the same time, another idea is, well, hunger is not always bad. The hunger signal is a signal that, well, our body might have just run out of readily available glucose and maybe stored carbohydrate, and it's just switching to tapping onto fat, because we always have some stored fat. The body always stores some fat for that middle-of-the-night hunger.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when it's trying to switch from one fuel source to another fuel source. Having said that, it's also understandable that some people may not have the right metabolisms. When that switch occurs, they may go through a low blood glucose, and that might wake them up. But that's a very small number of people, and if people are having those kind of hunger pangs and also feeling low blood glucose, dizziness, etc., they should check with their doctor.
How does the atmosphere in which we eat affect it? In other words, the lighting. If we eat outside or if we eat indoors, we spend a lot of our time indoors, a lot more than we did 200,000 years ago, right? So
yeah.
How does all that indoor lighting affect our internal clocks and our eating habits?
Yeah, so as I said, almost every cell, every organ in our body has a clock. So that means our brain also has clocks. And for a long period of time, we knew that the brain clock acts as the master clock. So that means if we reset our brain clock, then everything else falls into place. And this brain clock resets by light. So that means when we fly from one time zone to another time zone, and in the morning if we get exposed to bright daylight, then that resets our clock. So that means to really synchronize our body clock and brain clock to day-night cycle, it may be ideal, although we haven't clearly proven it in humans, how it implies to health conclusively. But it implies that having bright exposure to bright daylight, at least for 30 minutes in the morning, is very important to synchronize our brain clock. At the same time, we have also learned that eating in the first half of the day is good, because that's when our body clock is optimum to absorb the right amount of nutrition without raising our blood sugar level too high. So having major part of a meal, a bigger breakfast, maybe a modest lunch, is ideal for our body. So in that way, having exposure to bright daylight in the first half of the day, having more calories consumed in the first half of the day, is much better than eating that late into the night. Now, at nighttime, there is a different thing that's going on. At nighttime, our body, actually, our brain doesn't need that light. But when we are exposed to that light, bright light, and these days there are many bright blue LEDs that we put in our homes or in grocery stores and drug stores and many shopping complexes now, there's this bright light.
Mm-hmm.
That suppresses, reduces our melatonin level. And melatonin is a night hormone. It rises at night. It tells us to sleep. But when that melatonin level goes down, then we stay awake. And what happens is a sleep-deprived brain or an awake brain at night, that makes bad decisions about food. So that's when we crave for very fatty, sugary food. So it's kind of an indirect connection between how light at night can keep us sleep deprived, and a sleep deprived brain then makes the bad choice about food.
I'm wondering, you've said that everybody, we're all kind of wired basically the same. So genetics doesn't play a big role in this, or does genetics play some kind of role in it? Some kind of a fact, you know, is it one of a factor?
Genetics does play a role. We know that there are many people who are night owls and some are early birds.
Mm-hmm.
And now genetics is showing us that, yes, that's true. There is some genetic basis. Some people have some mutation that give them awake late into the night, and other people have a mutation that put them to sleep very early in the evening.
Mm-hmm.
So in that way, genetics does play a role. And we have also seen there is another common mutation in a protein that binds to this night hormone melatonin. And this mutation causes some kind of interesting artifact on the effect of melatonin on our blood sugar. So these people who have this mutation, if they eat late into the night, then they may have high blood sugar even a couple of hours after they had finished their meal. So in that way, genetics tells us that some people should not be eating late into the night. They are at a very high risk for obesity and diabetes.
Yeah.
And genetics is also telling us that some people may be natural night owl. They may be good for nighttime shift work. And whereas other people who are early birds, they may be good for early morning shift work.
What about exercise? Does that play much of a role in all of this?
Yes, exercise does play a role. Two ways. One is the circadian clock actually tells our muscles when to be most active and when we can do the most exercise without feeling too tired or without getting injured. And surprisingly, that time window seems to be the late afternoon. And it makes sense because our ancestors, early humans, when we are hunter-gatherers, we used to go out into the field or to the wilderness, and then just before sunset, we had to run back to home because night was dark and it was scary. Mm-hmm. So that's how we have this program into our muscle, that muscle tone and risk for injury. Muscle tone is very high and risk for injury is low in late afternoon.
Yeah.
Then the second part is nowadays, with very nice genetic studies coming out of a few labs, we are finding that if the muscles don't have a good circadian clock, then that affects sleep. So that seems to be now a nice, curious, very interesting connection between how muscles can affect sleep. We know for a very long time that, yes, if you are physically active during daytime, you may sleep well, and we thought that you may be just feeling tired, that's why you are sleeping well. But now the new genetic and molecular biology studies are saying, no, there is some connection. We don't know exactly what that signal is from muscle to brain, but this is a very new area of study, and it's just going to give us more clues about why exercise may be important even for sleep.
So if you have 15 seconds or 30 seconds to tell people, what's your advice given your knowledge about the relationship between the circadian clock and what you eat or when you eat, what do you tell them?
Well, I tell them try to be in bed for 8 hours. Mm-hmm. And after waking up, try to avoid food for at least an hour. And then after your first calorie count 10 hours to eat all your meals, and you can go maximum up to 12 hours, not beyond that. And time it so that your last meal is 2 to 3 hours before going to bed. And then during daytime, try to be outside for 30 minutes to get bright daylight, and try to avoid bright light for 2 to 3 hours before going to bed.
Sachin Panda, thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Sachin Panda is a circadian biologist at the Salk Institute for Biological Studies in La Jolla, California. He recently wrote about the issue of when you eat and when you sleep for The Conversation. We'll post a link to it on our website at wosu.org/allsides. Thanks for listening. This has been Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.